I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that two for-profit companies, Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties, had religious rights. And that meant the owners could refuse to provide contraceptive coverage to their employees because it violated their Christian beliefs. It was a 5-4 decision with a vigorous dissent from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Last week, the court struck down Massachusetts' 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics because it violated the First Amendment rights of protesters. It was a unanimous ruling. Today on Radio Times, religious liberty, reproductive rights, and the law, we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Let me introduce them to you. Tobias Barrington Wolf is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in the fields of civil procedure, complex litigation, and civil rights under the Constitution. Tobias, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Sarah Beringer Gordon, and she's the Arlen M. Adams Professor of Constitutional Law and Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Wrote a book called The Spirit of the Law. And Sarah/Sally, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And also with us is David Cohen, Associate Professor at Drexel University School of Law. He studies the intersection of constitutional law and gender. In fact, he's finishing up a book about harassment of abortion providers. David Cohen, you need a middle name. David Cohen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And Sally, if I could begin with you and begin with this Hobby Lobby decision, how should lay people understand what the court was saying?
Well, it's a complicated case, in part because it's not about a constitutional right to religion. It's about the interpretation of a statute that was enacted about 20 years ago by an outraged Congress that was mad at the Supreme Court's decision to deny religious rights to a plaintiff. And they wrote a statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, half of which, the part that applied to every state, so in Pennsylvania it doesn't apply, that was held unconstitutional by a later Supreme Court decision, striking down that half that applied to the states. The other part that applies to the federal government is still in place. And this decision was an interpretation, a very major interpretation, some would argue an expansion, of the law under that statute.
And would it be fair to say, at least applied to these companies and companies like these two, that companies have religious rights the way Citizens United said companies have free speech rights? Should we now think that a lot of companies in this country have religious rights?
Well, the decision was about two companies of vastly different sizes, but both of them are what are called closely held corporations, not ones that are traded on public stock exchanges, owned by limited numbers of people, in both cases, families. And to some extent, the majority opinion confined its decision to just closely held corporations. There is language in some places that seems to extend more broadly, but certainly closely held corporations, even of significant size, Hobby Lobby is a big company with many thousands of employees, would have these rights going forward, yes.
And what we're talking about specifically in these two cases has to do with contraception and certain forms of contraception. These companies believe that life begins at conception, and they object to certain kinds of contraception that they think violates that belief.
Intrauterine devices, morning after pills, a fertilized egg is what they're fighting about, or what they would fight about if the thing had actually gone through a full discovery and trial process. But yes, that's what it's about. It's not about all contraceptives. It's about a smaller group, depending on which plaintiff you're talking about.
Now, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg seemed to take away from this decision that this could apply to other religious beliefs, a belief perhaps about immunizations or blood transfusions. Do you read it that way? And then I do want to get some of our other two guests in on the conversation.
It's a great question. Her dissent sounded alarm bells and clearly wanted to sound alarm bells. The two decisions, the majority decision by Justice Alito and the dissent by Justice Ginsburg are written very broadly. They are sandwiched around a short concurrence by Justice Kennedy, the swing justice.
Right.
It's only about a four-page decision saying, listen, this is not going to change the world. This is just one opinion, and it's narrow. So we'll see. These predictions are raising the temperature, no doubt.
Is your temperature raised by this, Tobias?
Well, it is certainly the case that this is a very expansive interpretation of this federal statute. And there are portions of the opinion that go out of their way to say, we only have this one case in front of us, we're only deciding this one case in front of us. And Supreme Court decisions do that a lot. And if you look at many Supreme Court decisions that are the first major statement in what becomes a line of cases, the first case will say, we only have this one issue in front of us, we're deciding this one issue. But it contains a set of expansive statements of principle that then go on to be applied in subsequent cases. And so it remains to be seen what the court is going to do with this opinion. One of the things, there's a lot to talk about with this opinion, one of the things I'll mention right away is that the court was confronted with this question of what constitutes a substantial burden on religious exercise.
Right.
And there were two things that the court was asked to take a look at. One was the penalty that the Affordable Care Act imposes on companies that don't provide compliant insurance companies. And in a very short passage of the opinion, the court said this is a big penalty in dollar amounts. We have no problem concluding that's substantial. But the other question was, does it substantially burden the religious exercise of the company's owners if they have to comply with this requirement that in providing insurance to their employees, certain options have to be available to their employees? And that's a fairly attenuated relationship between the company's owners' personal beliefs and anything that they're directly involved in, right? And so one of the arguments in the case was, this is just too attenuated. If this was a direct imposition on your exercise, that would be one thing. But this is part of the business transaction of running a company. And one of the most remarkable things about this opinion is that what the court says is, we're not going to second guess the statement by the company's owners that they view this as a burden on their religion and so their religious exercise. It's enough for us that they say so. And so there are these options that the court says the federal government should have employed instead of a direct mandate. It's not hard to imagine the next case in which the government implements the solution that the court says is available to it in this case. And another company's owners say, we still think our religion is burdened here. We don't like the idea that our employees have contraceptive coverage no matter where they're getting it from. And that burdens our religious exercise. Hmm. And this opinion seems to stand for the proposition that the courts would have to defer to that company's statement about how the law is burdening their religious exercise.
And just a quote, and I want to get you in on the conversation, David Cohen. Alito says, it's not for us to say their religious beliefs are mistaken or substantial, which is that we're not going to sort of weigh in whether why people believe what they believe. If they believe it, then we believe them.
And that becomes a big issue.
Go ahead, David.
When you get beyond these two companies who only objected to four of the 20 types of contraception, because there are other companies out there that have litigated and are in the lower courts that object to all forms of contraception. So those cases, given what Tobias just spelled out, those company owners who have sincere beliefs that all forms of contraception violate their religion, they're going to be able to opt out as well, because there's nothing in this decision. Although the decision deals with two companies that only object to four types of contraception, there's nothing limiting this decision to only those four types. So now you're going to have closely held religious and for-profit employers who say, we don't want to provide any contraception to our employees, and that's going to have drastic effects. And the court on Tuesday denied hearing those cases, left them in place that allowed those employers to opt out. But a couple cases in which the lower courts had found that those companies were not able to opt out reversed those cases and sent them back to the lower courts for rehearing in light of this decision. So one of them, Eden Foods, which is one of these organic food companies, that appeals to all these liberal urban types. They're actually very conservative. They want to deny contraception to all their employees. And the Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit had said that that was not allowed. But the Supreme Court reversed that case, remanded it to the Sixth Circuit for reconsideration in light of this decision. And it's hard to see how the Sixth Circuit will not interpret this decision to allow Eden Foods to deny contraception to all its employees.
Let me go back to you, Sally, and also this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's what we have been talking about. I, in my ignorance, would think that it would apply to the ability to worship. I mean, the sort of activity or worship the way one wants to, perhaps the sort of activity of worship. This is really talking about what someone believes.
Yes. One of the interesting things about the law of religion in the United States is that it is very much about individual conscience and individual belief. One of the reasons the majority opinion says it's not for us to tell the plaintiffs that their beliefs are wrong or misguided, is that there's an extraordinary level of deference to the individual to describe his or her religious beliefs, absolutely. And it extends far beyond the mere act of worship. For example, think of conscientious objection. We recognize the ability to behave consistent with one's beliefs as well.
What about do employees at either of these two companies, do they have rights to bias? Can I toss that to you?
Well, they have rights as against the federal government. Their statute, RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, Sally mentioned this, it's worth reiterating, it only relates to limits on federal law. For a complicated set of reasons that we can get into if we need to. It doesn't relate to how state and local law operates. It only relates to federal law. And so if federal law sought to impose requirements on individual workers that they thought burdened their religion, they might have a claim under this opinion. But they don't have claims against their private relationships with their companies, right? And I want to also emphasize this distinction that Sally just mentioned. It's a subtle distinction, but I think it's actually really important, which is the difference between saying that the courts should not be in the business of second-guessing people's beliefs and the way in which they articulate their religious beliefs, which I think is clearly correct, and saying, and therefore that means that the federal courts also can't have any role to play in deciding when religious exercise, the practice of religion, is being interfered with. And what this decision does quite directly is to say that there's no real difference between those two things, that the requirement that we stay away from people's religious beliefs also requires us to stay away from what people tell us is a burden on their religious exercise. And it's that which it's not clear how that's going to work going forward under this statute.
Let's take a very short break. I know you want to say something, David. Hold on to that thought. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking about what is now called the Hobby Lobby decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, talking with Tobias Barrington-Wolf, Sarah Beringer-Gordon, and David Cohen. And we want to hear from you. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Allentown Symphony Pops supports WHYY and presents a tribute to Benny Goodman. Clarinetist Dave Bennett and his band come to town to relive the swing era. Saturday, July 12th at 8 p.m. Bennett's stage presence, knowledge of the dates and details of Goodman recordings, and his penchant for wire-rimmed glasses, spats, and double-breasted suits transport audiences back to the time and mood of Benny Goodman's swing era. For information, millersymphonyhall.org.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and a listener left a voicemail with this suggestion for you.
You can bust into any conversation and say, hey, have you heard this story? You can have the wit of the greatest comedian. You can be as sensitive as a poet. Steal everything from This American Life and claim it as your own.
Let the theft begin this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's been 38 years since the Supreme Court reinstituted the death penalty, and Professor Robert Blecker says it's necessary for some crimes.
The sadistic killers, mass murderers, terrorists, there's a group that we can clearly identify.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with three law professors about the court's ruling on Monday, the Hobby Lobby ruling, as it's now called. David Cohen, associate professor at Drexel University's School of Law. Sarah Beringer-Gordon is a professor of constitutional law, also a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And Tobias Barrington-Wolf, a professor of law, also at Penn. And the phones have exploded at 1-888-477-94. David, let me go to you. We've been focusing on the owners of Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties, their rights as the court sees them. But do employees have a right, especially under the Affordable Care Act, for contraceptive coverage, which is, you know, is part of the Affordable Care Act? It was passed by Congress. It's offered to millions of other women, in this case, in the country.
Right, and that was exactly what one of the great things about the Affordable Care Act. Before the Affordable Care Act, there was no requirement that employers include contraception. In fact, they could cover every other form of preventive health care for men and women, but carve out contraception. And a lot of employers did. So that was one of the things that the Affordable Care Act solved, was requiring employers to cover basic preventive health care for women, which is what contraception is. And by doing so, the Affordable Care Act really helped women all over the country, both in terms of preventing pregnancy because they don't want to be pregnant or because pregnancy could be life-threatening or health-threatening, but also other health benefits that come with contraceptive use. And so that was one of the great things about the Affordable Care Act that it corrected. Mm-hmm. And this case says that for certain employers, that's no longer. And for the women who work there, they have to pay out of their pocket. And as Justice Ginsburg excellently points out in her dissent, an IUD, which for some women is medically indicated and required, or the best method, that can cost over $1,000, which for a minimum wage worker can be over a month's worth of pay. And so we're talking a significant expense for some forms of contraception that now people, women who work at these companies are going to have to pay out of their pocket.
Sally, the court also seemed to be saying is that there is a workaround in that the government or insurance companies can do what has been done for not-for-profit religious institutions, which is essentially have the insurance companies pay, and then they get, I guess, paid back by the federal government.
Exactly. And that was the line that the government wanted to hold to. They wanted to draw a line in the sand between for-profit and not-for-profit. Instead, they drew sort of a line around closely held corporations. I'm not sure either of those makes terrific sense, but it would at least allow people to organize around a given line.
But Tobias, that says then that if it ends up that the taxpayers pick up the bill, then because Hobby Lobby pays taxes, do they end up then providing contraception that they say they don't believe in because they think it's an abortion?
It's a good question. That's an issue that the court has taken up in the past under its constitutional free exercise doctrine. And there's a complicated relationship between those cases and this statutory RFRA case. But the long and the short of it is that everyone on the court seems to agree that religious objections to paying taxes are not going to get you anywhere under this doctrine. It is worth mentioning, I think, very briefly, that the court's articulation of this alternative, that the most straightforward way to do this is just to have the government pay for it itself. Right. There's an irony to the majority saying that, which is that, as the majority presumably knows very well, the political treatment of governmental funding of anything that is understood to relate to abortion is very fraught and has been in the direction of restrictions on government funding those procedures. And it almost has a kind of willful refusal to recognize the political reality that gave rise to the contraceptive coverage in the ACA in the first place to say, well, why didn't you just have the government do this itself?
Well, and just to add to this, the FDA and some other, I guess, science or medical-based organizations say what we're talking about is not abortion. This is contraception. These people believe it is abortion because they believe that life begins at conception. I'm looking at you, David.
Right, and that's where the court said we're not going to question their beliefs. If they believe that birth control through an IUD, emergency pill, or even birth control pills is abortion, they may be wrong, but we're not going to question that. The court says that's not their job. But I think on this point of the government paying, it's an important point because that could be the solution to every anti-discrimination law, which is where the court's decision could be really dangerous. The court says we're not talking about race discrimination, but why isn't it a solution, another alternative, rather than requiring employers to pay people the same based on race or sex, to say the government's going to make up the difference? Right. So if you pay your white employees $10 an hour, but your African-American employees $5 an hour, that's not illegal. Just make the government pay that $5 an hour difference, or women and men. Under the court's decision, that's an alternative that the court endorses, which is another way that this decision could open up a huge can of worms.
Well, and Sally, what I've seen, and I'm sure you have as well, is some people are saying this is why we shouldn't have employer mandated insurance, which we should sort of get your boss out of your health decisions and go for a single payer. I mean, I'm not saying that that's the solution, but certainly that's been a critique.
Right. I mean, one way to think of it is that the court has put a very strong foot down against a wide-ranging kinds of regulation that treat companies as part of the regulated environment. And the answer should be a far broader, more, if you will, socialized medicine, which will then excite its own forms of...
Yeah, I have to say, all of our guests just perked up when you just said
that. The irony here is that that's been... The reason we have employer-based health insurance is because we haven't had socialized medicine, and that's been fought against vigorously.
Right.
And now the court's decision to protect employers is saying, make it socialized with the government.
Here we are, Tobias. Now go ahead, and then I do want to get to some callers.
Well, and one of the issues that it might make sense for us to talk about a little bit is the relationship between this decision and protections against discrimination in the workplace. And we can get into that in due course. But my guess is that if a company actually did what David just suggested, right, I'm going to pay my black workers less than my white workers or my female workers less than my male workers and let the government make it up, my guess is that the court's response would be, this isn't just about differences in money. This is about a dignitary harm that's being inflicted upon people of color in the workplace or women in the workplace. And that's a harm that the government is allowed to protect people against. Mm. But of course, part of the point of the contraception mandate is not just the economic cost of access to this particular medical service, but also allowing women to have access to this service without having to be subjected to the kinds of stigma and singling out that had previously characterized insurance coverage. And that's part of what the government was trying to protect women from. And that idea just appears nowhere in the majority's opinion.
Isn't that called equality? I mean, treating people equally?
Yeah.
And that's Tobias Barrington-Wolf, also with us, Sarah Baringer-Gordon, and David Cohen. We're talking about the Hobby Lobby decision, Monday's Supreme Court ruling, and we will be talking about some of the other rulings as well, but we have an explosion of phone calls here. Let me get Karen from New Jersey to join our conversation. Karen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to make a note that I'm in the car with my sister, and we're driving listening to your program, and she mentioned that within the past couple weeks she had listened to an NPR program recently where a female speaker said something about 99% of all women have used or are using contraceptives. And I am a former military member who, during the 80s, was put on contraception for a non-pregnancy or non-contraceptive use, but for a different medical issue. And my question is, are the companies that are addressing this, the use of this contraceptives, aware that women are, it's imposed upon us in some cases for non-contraceptive use. And I'd also like to note that I am gay and have always been gay. I had never, ever planned on getting pregnant. So this was not a decision for that I wanted, but it was a solution to a medical issue provided by my medical provider.
Karen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And David, I'm going to toss that to you.
A couple points on this. One, the decision would say that even for medically required, it has nothing to do with preventing pregnancy, that the employer could refuse contraceptive coverage. So this decision is broad. The company is claiming the right to do that. And you're absolutely right to point out that over 99% of women in this country have used some form of contraception in their lives, and that is across the board with respect to religion and religious beliefs. So this is not something where people who are of a particular religion that is opposed to contraception don't use it. They do. So this is one of the universals in American life is that women have used contraception in their life, and the court is ignoring that fact. As Tobias rightly points out, there is nothing in the majority opinion about women's health, women's equality, and the importance to public health that contraceptive coverage provides.
Sally, we have an email from Judith. These are Christian beliefs upheld by five Christian men. What if a Muslim-owned company says their rights are infringed upon? Do you see it opening the door to something like that?
That's a great question, because we are the most religiously diverse country on the planet. And so the idea that there would be others who would raise related or even identical issues is predictable. The note I guess I want to take from that email especially is that five Christian men, right? All the women on the court dissented. So we have some gender politics here as well as lots of politics about religion and race. And it's worth noting how differently the women on the court would resolve the case.
Interesting. I want to segue to something that you were involved in, Tobias. This was a case, a New Mexico case that got ruled by the Supreme Court. I'm not going to try to summarize. I'm going to make you do that. But I think it's related to what we're talking about.
Sure. This was a case that got a lot of attention in the media, as it turned out. It was a case involving a wedding photography business in New Mexico that turned away a couple, a lesbian couple, because they were a lesbian couple, and wouldn't take business from them. And they asserted both a religious objection to providing their services to a lesbian couple, and they also wound up trying to make a free speech argument. And I represented the couple, specifically the woman, Vanessa Willick, who had been discriminated against by this company. And we wound up winning unanimously before the New Mexico Supreme Court, and actually just a couple of months ago, the Supreme Court of the United States decided not to hear the case. And Justice Ginsburg winds up citing that case in her dissenting opinion. And the question of whether the principles that the court ascribes to RFRA would apply to federal anti-discrimination laws as well, discrimination laws in the workplace, discrimination laws in public accommodations in the commercial arena, big open question. The one thing that the court says about that in Hobby Lobby, which was quite striking, is the court says we reject the idea that our decision would authorize race discrimination in the workplace because the government has a compelling interest in providing an equal opportunity to participate in the workforce without regard to race, and prohibitions on racial discrimination are precisely tailored to achieve that critical goal. Mm-hmm. The court said that just kind of out of nowhere, with no citation to anything else. That's a somewhat reassuring statement in that opinion, but it leaves open a question whether other forms of workplace discrimination against women, against disabled people, against people over the age of 40, all kinds of other discrimination would be covered under the same principle. And there are reasons to at least question whether that court would be prepared to apply that that doctrine with respect to race discrimination to these other areas as well.
Let me get another caller in. We have Paul from Villanova joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So my question pertains to the balance between stated belief and practice. And I was wondering if there's any comment on if an employer that claims, quote-unquote Christian values is in one of these closely held companies is caught having an affair or in a prostitution ring or doing something that goes against said values, could then an employee bring suit against them and say, okay, now your closely held beliefs are now defunct because you've shown you don't actually hold them?
Well, that's
and the opinion. Yeah.
No. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Paul. No, that's a fascinating, and I have to say all of our guests are sort of nodding and grinning enthusiastically. Sally, I'm going to toss that to you.
Thank you for that question, Paul, which was vivid.
Yes, to say the least.
I guess the standard for any court hearing a claim is sincerity, and it is possible for a plaintiff to undermine their own claim to sincerely believe something by acting in defiance of it enough times. It is also the case that we have seen, and I think your question raises it, a number of high-profile religious leaders caught in exactly this kind of embarrassing situation and having to walk back.
Well, and let me just throw something out here, only because I was doing some noodling around the internet last night and ran across a couple of a born-again Christian radio hosts who criticized Hobby Lobby because they do business with China and its policies on abortion, on labor as well. Does the issue of sincerity resonate with you, David?
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't in the record of the case, but afterwards, it was either The Nation or Mother Jones that
did
an investigative report about Hobby Lobby's investments and found that Hobby Lobby invests heavily in mutual fund companies that have, as part of their portfolio, the makers of IUDs and emergency contraception. So Hobby Lobby invests in those companies. And this was one of those things where you wish that it had been investigated earlier and become part of the record, although I don't think it would have changed the outcome of the case. But it does go directly to the sincerity of their beliefs.
Go ahead, Tobias.
Yeah, and the sincerity issue, the cases, some of the cases at least in which sincerity has wound up playing a role are cases where it's the court determines that this is simply a fraudulent religious belief that is being asserted. The Supreme Court in Hobby Lobby cites a case from the 10th Circuit out of New Mexico, as it happens, where marijuana sellers and distributors were claiming that they were a member of the Church of the something or other, and that, you know, selling marijuana in vast quantities was their religious belief and practice. And the court rejects that argument by saying, you're just making this up. This isn't a real thing. That's a very different proposition from saying to somebody, you have sincere religious beliefs, but you're just not consistent in the way that you live them. And my guess is, and I think appropriately, that the courts would be very skittish about questioning somebody's sincerity by inquiring into whether they're consistent in the way they live their religious beliefs. The place where you would expect that kind of question to enter into the analysis is in asking, we accept your religious beliefs, are they substantially burdened by what you're being asked to do? And that's the part of the analysis where the court in Hobby Lobby said, we defer to what the believer tells us, we're not going to inquire, which is part of why that part of the opinion is quite dramatic.
We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. I do want to talk about the ruling on protests and abortion clinics after this very short break, talking with Tobias Barrington-Wolf, Sarah Beringer-Gordon, and David Cohen about some fascinating Supreme Court rulings this session. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A Prairie Home Companion celebrates its 40th anniversary this 4th of July weekend from the campus of McAllister College in St. Paul, where it all began. We'll be joined by more than 50 musical guests, including Old Crow Medicine Show and the Waylon Jennies, many more, and the news from Lake Wobegon. This is Garrison Keillor. Hope you'll join us.
Saturday night at 6 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the Supreme Court term that just ended with Adam Liptak, the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. We'll review major decisions and discuss what they reveal about the nine justices. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
America is America, except how we divide ourselves up determines our politics and how we allocate resources in virtually everything we do. In the past 5 years, America has been on the move and absorbing influxes of all kinds. What does that mean for election 2014 or even 16? The red-blue mix of America's electoral pie. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We've spent the last 40 minutes talking about the Hobby Lobby decision by the U.S. Supreme Court this week. And again, our guests are Sarah Beringer Gordon. She's a professor of constitutional law and history at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, author of several books, including one called The Spirit of the Law. Tobias Barrington Wolf, a professor of law, also at Penn, specializing in the fields of civil procedure, complex litigation, and civil rights under the Constitution. And also with us, David Cohen. He's an associate professor at Drexel University School of Law. He studies the intersection of constitutional law and gender, finishing up a book about the harassment of abortion providers, which is why I want to segue into this other court decision, basically striking down Massachusetts' 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics in that state, saying it violated the First Amendment rights of procedures. This was a unanimous vote. And I'll go to you, David Cohen. So what is the court saying to us about, I guess, protest?
Right. So almost everyone's familiar with the fact that abortion clinics are protested. And one of the ways that some jurisdictions have tried to deal with the issue is creating zones around clinics where protesters cannot approach patients. That if you're walking down the street and you have to patronize a business next door, you can walk through. But a protester who's trying to talk to a patient, yell at a patient, yell at a provider, has to step back a certain amount of feet. And so Pittsburgh and Harrisburg, for example, in Pennsylvania, have laws like this. But Massachusetts enacted a law like this that said 35 feet around a clinic has to be this no-protest zone.
Right.
And Massachusetts has a particular history that's important to remember, which is that in the history of legalized abortion, there have been 8 abortion providers who have been murdered since 1993, 2 of whom were murdered in Boston. There were 2 clinic workers, Shannon Lowney was one of them in Boston and Brookline, Massachusetts, who were just slaughtered. So, an anti-abortion extremist walked into the clinics and just shot the receptionists at 2 different clinics in that area. This was on the minds of the Massachusetts legislature. They first enacted a no-protest law in 2000. That law was not working, so they enacted a new one, and that was the law that was issued before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said that this law violates the free speech rights of the people who want to talk to the patients entering the clinics.
In fact, quoting Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the opinion that he's taught these protesters or these people outside the clinics, they want to offer counseling and information, personal caring, and consensual conversations. I'm sure that goes on at some of these clinics, but as we know, there are other clinics where there's a lot of shouting and a lot of, you know.
Right. I mean, if you go a couple blocks west of here to the Philadelphia Women's Center on a Saturday or Friday morning, you will not see just little old ladies talking quietly like to the patients walking in, which is how this decision talks about them. You will see people shouting, yelling, screaming, trying to get in the way of people trying to enter the clinic and the people working at these clinics trying to get in. And the problem is that although this plaintiff may have said, I am quiet, I am peaceful, all I want to do is talk to people about their decision, there is no way for any patient, any clinic worker, any police officer to know if she's carrying a gun or if she has some other nefarious purpose. And given the history of violence at abortion clinics in this country, that is a serious problem. The National Abortion Federation collects statistics of violence around abortion clinics. And just to show that this is not an old problem, between 2010 and 2013, there were 9 attempted or successful bombings and arsons. There were 66 acts of vandalism, 425 incidents of trespassing, 8 clinic invasions, 2 anthrax threats, 14 assaults and batteries, 12 death threats, 18 bomb threats, 26 acts of burglary, and 34 acts of stalking, all within since 2010. These are very real, concrete, current problems that this buffer zone was attempting to help, and the Supreme Court struck it down.
Well, and Sally, just picking up what you said about the previous decision where all the women were on one side and the men on the other side, this was a 9-0 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. How do you see what the court is saying here? And then I'll get you in, Tobias, as well.
Very good point. I do think that the idea of obstreperous and messy speech, which is what was at issue here, and I think David is very right about the dangers and about the fact that they didn't appear adequately in the opinion. But nonetheless, the idea that protesters must be protected and even in places where we don't like them is, I think, fundamental to the decision.
But what's so interesting, Tobias, is we learned that you cannot protest in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a kind of buffer zone. And it seems like the court is saying, you know, sidewalks is where you can have your protests or use your First Amendment rights, I guess.
Right. And I mean, the issue with the buffer zone around the court is an interesting one.
It is.
And it partly has to do with the rather unfortunate question of what is a sidewalk. But
Is that
one of the big things at issue there? Yeah. But, you know, the buffer zone case, I think, is a really hard case for a couple of reasons. One is there's a really important difference between responses on a case-by-case basis to protesters who are behaving in ways which are clearly not protected by the First Amendment. You don't have a First Amendment right to assault somebody. You don't have a First Amendment right to physically menace somebody. You don't have a First Amendment right to engage in a lot of the bad behaviors that David describes. And, of course, it's very difficult to police bad behavior on that kind of case-by-case basis, and it's expensive. What Massachusetts and other jurisdictions have tried to do is to create a law sort of before the fact, right, that creates a buffer zone that applies across the board. The idea being this is enough of a problem that case-by-case responses are not working.
Yeah.
And it's easy to understand why they thought that they had to do that, but it has very different implications under the First Amendment, right? But the second thing that I think it's important never to forget here is all of the other forms of legal restraint on access that women have to reproductive health services, including abortion, which we're seeing this avalanche of laws around the country that are shutting down these clinics. It means that the remaining clinics are that much more vulnerable and exposed to this kind of targeted protest. If a woman had access to the procedures that she wanted at a multitude of facilities around the state, around the city where she lives, then the threat that she would experience of this kind of hostile protest would be much less focused. And it's the combination of limits on access to health services for women and then the difficult First Amendment questions that surround protests that really, I think, define a lot of what's going on here.
Let me toss something else out. I looked up the court's ruling on the Westboro Baptist Church. As we know, they protest funerals for all sorts of bizarre and really horrifying reasons. But nonetheless, the court ruled, it was an 8-1 decision, that they had the right to protest. Chief Justice Roberts says what Westboro said in the whole context of how and where to choose to say it is entitled to special protection under the First Amendment, and that protection cannot be overcome by a jury finding that the picketing was outrageous. And I wonder if there isn't some parallel. If you can protest someone's funeral for all the sort of horrible reasons that Westboro does, perhaps that also allows for people to yell at people who want to go in and get contraceptive care.
Right, and I think there is that connection, but there's also a few major differences. The people of the Westboro Baptist Church are not trying to deny the people access to the cemetery in that case. And so there was no instance of, we're trying to convince you not to have a funeral, or we are trying to actually block you from having a funeral. They're having their funeral and they're just talking. The protesters are trying to make sure that women cannot access reproductive health care. And they're doing it in a variety of ways. But that's one difference. Two, to the best of my knowledge, the Westboro Baptist Church has never bombed, vandalized, killed, harassed, stalked people. And that is an omnipresent concern of people who work at clinics. Even if it has happened in far away places, this is something that is known, that people, clinic workers think, people like me have been murdered. Not just doctors, not just high-profile doctors, receptionists and others have been murdered because of this line of work. That is an always present threat that the court was completely silent about.
Let me go back to our callers, and I also have an email from David. He says he's a Christian business owner, oversees 1,000 people. He believes it's God's law not to use medically unnecessary drugs. Does he have a right to deny those drugs to his employees? I mean, obviously, we're just that's all I have. But I'd be curious, Sally, do you think he does, or is there any way to know that based on the court ruling?
I think in most cases, what is medically necessary is not up to the employer, but usually a doctor. Whether this new case will destabilize that is an interesting question. But my guess is that there's significant reluctance to dive in too far.
I mean, I think one way to answer David's question is that under this new decision, insofar as federal law is telling him that he has to provide something to his employees, it is possible that his assertion that that burdens his religious practice might give him a right to challenge that federal requirement. Exactly whether that challenge would succeed is a much more complicated question that we can't get into without knowing more about it. But insofar as federal law is telling him you need to provide this to your employees, there is now a new basis for him to say federal law can't tell me that because it burdens my religious exercise.
This law doesn't tell employers how to tell their employees how to live, does it? Or does it?
Well, RFRA certainly doesn't mandate that employers do anything with respect to their employees. RFRA gives them a defense against federal law, right? So that's an important distinction. RFRA is about limiting the effect of other federal laws.
Did you want to say something?
And employers are free to talk to their employees however they want, as long as they're not being discriminatory or violating a law. So if they want to encourage employees to not use medically unnecessary drugs, they can do that. They just can't discriminate based on certain categories or violate federal mandates. But employers are always free to talk to their employees about various aspects of life.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Mark from Chestnut Hill. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, this is a great conversation,
as
usual.
Thank you.
You know, in all of these discussions, I've heard an awful lot about employers wanting to or not wanting to or not being allowed to put limits on what's available to women and contraception. I've never heard anyone discuss vasectomies and whether they are included or cannot be included in the insurance.
Mark, I'm going to toss that to Sally. Why is it always about women?
Thanks
and contraception?
So much.
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, Hobby Lobby is happy to fund vasectomies.
Oh, interesting. Yes.
And Viagra.
And
yeah,
Viagra
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. So vasectomies do not kill a fertilized egg, which is the focus of that case.
So it's about fertilized egg.
Well, let me just add, there's a telling part of the court's opinion where the court says, Justice Ginsburg in her dissent and the Department of Health and Human Services are arguing that under our opinion, people would be able to resist blood transfusions, vaccinations, access to a wide variety of medical procedures and drugs, and therefore we have to draw a line that says for-profit companies don't get to make this kind of claim. And their first response to that is to say, well, that can't possibly be the line, because if it were, that would lead to the conclusion that if federal law said employers have to provide care that includes access to third trimester abortions or assisted suicide, that would also be covered. And clearly that would be atrocious. And the fact that the court is saying that it's obvious to us that the following covered procedures would be unacceptable to require that mandate. It seems to indicate that the court has a view about what does or doesn't really implicate religious belief in a way that they're prepared to recognize. Mm. And one presumes that if a case is presented to them in which a company says we follow Sharia law or we follow a set of Hindu beliefs, that the court will be equally open to hearing those beliefs. But in practice, which burdens are they going to view as really being substantial? It ought to operate the same with respect to all religious traditions and all religious beliefs, and whether the court will be prepared to apply that principle outside of a particular set of Christian beliefs that are focused on reproduction is an interesting question.
David, go ahead. I think the caller gets at a bigger point, which is a lot of these cases, both of the cases we're talking about today, are about often men, usually men, not exclusively, but usually men trying to control women's bodies and women's sexuality. And that's why employers are not making a big deal about vasectomy or Viagra. They're talking about controlling women. And that's what these cases are about.
I don't want to just let that sit there, but that's worth a whole hour there. But let me go back to you, David, and even going back to these buffer zones, I guess, that no longer exist in Massachusetts. But are people do people have rights to be protected from speech they don't want to hear? I mean, there are certain things you can't yell fire in a movie theater. I mean, there are certain limits on people's First Amendment rights.
Right, and there are all sorts of exceptions under the First Amendment. But generally, no, you don't have a right to not hear unwelcome speech. But you do have a right not to be, for instance, obstructed to get into a women's health clinic. There's a federal law that prohibits that. You have rights not to be harassed in certain ways, not to be assaulted, not to be victims of various crimes. And these laws are prophylactic, these buffer zones, to try and prevent these things, given that, you know, policing this on a one-on-one basis, violation by violation, is impractical and doesn't prevent. This law would prevent. And so the court says that patients don't have a right to be free from unwelcome speech, but that's not what this is getting at. This is about safety, obstruction, and access to health care, and you have a right to those things.
And very, very quickly.
What's hard about this case, I think David's framed the issues correctly, what's hard about this case is that a buffer zone does restrict speech in service of that goal, and how much is a state allowed to do that? That's right. What's hard.
Well, we could go on, but we can't. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times, a real education, certainly for me, and I think for our listeners as well. Tobias Barrington-Wolf, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Beringer-Gordon, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
And David Cohen, thank you for joining us
as well. Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, we posted some candids on our Facebook page. You can check them out. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.